You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Adam Pryor. I teach at Bethany College in Lindsborg, Kansas. The one item I guarantee I would never buy at a truck stop is sushi, but also can be found there. Found it while driving through Iowa, which seems like a particularly bad place to buy sushi at a truck stop.
I'm Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania. And the one food that I would not consider purchasing from a truck stop is anything that is slowly spinning on metal cylinders.
Rachel Jackson, Gudis Israel Synagogue. And something I wouldn't buy from a truck stop would actually be anything that wasn't pre-sealed, packaged.
My name is Ian Benz, associate professor of elementary science education at UNC Charlotte. I'd say the one thing I would not buy at a truck stop would also be anything on the little metal spigots, just slowly spinning that look like they've been there for days.
So I'm a total hypocrite, because I say this and I know that they're bad ideas, but I have definitely purchased things that are slowly rolling and leaking out their juices in open air on vaguely warm cylinders from truck stops. I've done it. I've done it more times than I'm proud to admit. But since I already have no shame on this podcast, I might as well admit that as well. And every single time I've regretted it, of course, then you're stuck in a car and it's terrible. But I keep on going back to it and I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know what's wrong with me. Well, there are many things wrong with me. I could see if my therapist could send me her file, and we could put it in the show notes. But
bulleted list.
One of my favorite terrible places when I was growing up was Chi-Chi's. Did you guys ever have a Chi-Chi's where you were?
No, what that is.
What?
I'm the only. They didn't have Chi-Chi's in Germany.
It's funny because they do now.
So be nice.
But they don't have any in America anymore. Chi-Chi's? I think they have them.
Could you describe it for those of us that are unfamiliar with what you're even saying?
Yes. Chi-Chi's was a Tex-Mex chain restaurant that was real big in the 90s. There was one that we used to stop at on our way back from the shore every single week. And again, if you're not from this area, that means the beach. I don't know how much I have to translate of my whatever. So
Jerseyan.
I do remember what you're talking about. I looked it up. Yep, I do remember that.
Chi-Chi's was known for its fried ice cream, which oof. I did the thing with the phone.
You did the thing.
I did the thing. All right.
Don't do the thing.
So Chi-Chi's was known for its fried ice cream, which I don't know how they did. And now they're gone, and so we'll never know. They took the secret to the grave with them.
No. Can I interrupt? Please come down to North Carolina for the state fair. Because they fry everything. So I've had fried ice cream.
Where is the state fair?
Raleigh.
Which city?
It's in Raleigh.
Oh, yeah, no.
In the fall.
I know. You can always find fried things at state fairs. I just can't find it anywhere else. And no other restaurant will fry their ice cream. So Chi-Chi's was the best. And I loved Chi-Chi's. And there were at one point a couple hundred of them around the country. They were rated 7 years in a row as America's number one Mexican restaurant.
Wow.
Which recently... Taco Bell won that distinction. So,
that says a lot.
Come on.
It says that Americans don't vote, is what it says.
Yeah.
So,
and so they were the best people out there who really love Taco Bell. I'm sorry, but blah.
No, I love Taco Bell. I'm not knocking Taco Bell. I definitely do the 5 for 5. But that is not my favorite. I couldn't put that as my favorite Mexican restaurant. But
nor
I'm not
really
knocking Taco Bell
food.
That's part of the issue.
You know, they tried to sell.
Nor is it really a restaurant.
They tried to sell corn tortillas for a while to be authentic, and they started getting complaints in because people thought that their tacos were uncooked. They were saying that you served us raw taco shells. And so they stopped because they didn't want people thinking that they sold raw food. So they're not real Mexican. And nor was Chi-Chi's. To bring us back, Chi-Chi's was not real Mexican either. It was Tex-Mex. However, in 2003, just a month after having to file a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, Chi-Chi's was hit with the largest hepatitis A outbreak in U.S. history.
Ooh.
This was in around the Pittsburgh area. There were 660 victims of this hepatitis A outbreak. Four people died. There were whole high schools that were affected because it spread, and they traced it back to the green onions at the Chi-Chi's at the Beaver Valley Mall near Monica, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. So Chi-Chi's, they settled the case, and they were already kind of going down, but they started closing restaurants because people stopped coming. And even if you weren't near the Pittsburgh area, suddenly it was like, oh, Chi-Chi's, that's the hepatitis place. And they started having to close, and they closed more stores and more stores, and then they were done. And then in 2004, they got bought out by Outback. Outback was intending to maybe reuse some of their spaces or reuse the brand, but they didn't end up doing a whole lot with it. And all of the remaining Chi-Chi's restaurants just stayed vacant and dead and sad and presumably full of hepatitis A. There was even a blog there was a blog that someone created called creepyabandonedchichis.blogspot.com, I think. Link in the show notes. And it is just a series of pictures of the internal and external of Chi-Chi's restaurants that had been shut down and how they were now kind of ghost towns of restaurants.
Huh.
So you can find Chi-Chi's now in the salsa aisle of your grocery store, because now it's being just rebranded and sold in that way, because everyone now has forgotten about the hepatitis A thing.
Boy, it doesn't take long to outlive hepatitis A in terms of people's memories. That's
a little
disturbing. But I'm also sort of stuck on the idea about, like, so this, if this is like a mid-Atlantic thing, is there something about like repeating phrases in stores there? Like, because you said Chi-Chi's and all I could think of was Wawa. And I was like, it feels like it's kind of sad. Like, I want you all to say whole words.
Patronize away, Adam.
I don't know what Wawa is either.
Wawa is a convenience type store and gas station.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Do you have Sheetz?
Yes.
It's like Sheetz.
Sheetz?
Sheetz. Imagine if you will.
What happened to just like Conoco and Exxon and Mobil and Shell? Like, why?
Those names are no more or less ridiculous than Sheetz and Wawa.
I don't know.
Or come and
I've
go.
I've got some deep questions about the ridiculousness of the name Wawa.
I do. But at least with Shell, it is totally ridiculous, but it has the association that it is gas.
So,
and
hey,
Mobil,
hey,
is
Adam,
a gas. I don't know what Wawa is or
Sheetz. Let me defend my hometown here for a second. The name Wawa comes from the company's first milk plant and corporate headquarters in Wawa, Pennsylvania. The name Wawa is from the Ojibwe word for the Canadian goose. So that's why there's an image of the goose on it.
That does
so
make
the town
feel
is made named after a Native American word, which then the chain of convenience stores is named after the town. So
the first time I moved to New Jersey, I was just deeply concerned that the person who was telling me that I should go get coffee from Wawa was like having a stroke or something and was unable to speak anymore.
Oh, I can't wait to cut all of this out from the podcast.
It just sounded so made up.
Yeah, because we don't want people to be like, man, he's insensitive to culture. Which
right?
We know you're not.
To people from the Northeast and to the Ojibwe.
Well, let me make a segue so that you might be able to salvage some of that. So what we've been talking about is the names of places and what they sell and then the reputation that they get. But what we're really getting after is that using the name or the legacy of a place, how that impacts our trust of said place.
Exactly.
So for all the people that knew of the hepatitis A Chi-Chi's now might go to the grocery store and remember that and not trust that brand. But for everybody else that goes, what's Chi-Chi's? Is that new paste picante sauce? I don't really know. I'll try it. There is no mistrust in there, right? So same thing with, I don't understand this word. What was it? Wawa? Like that, because it's not a language that I'm familiar with. And because it's not a language I'm familiar with, I automatically put up a barrier between myself and whatever it might be. And I create within myself a biased mistrust to it that has to then be broken down by someone, say like you, Zach, who says, yeah, Wawa is the place to go for
food and drink.
Spinny taquitos.
I don't know if they have spinny
taquitos.
No,
I think Wawa is too fancy for spinny taquitos.
Wawa has amazing hoagies, which you might know as sub sandwiches or some other nonsense.
Let me be clear to all the people in the Northeast. I do love Wawa after living there. It was really wonderful. It was just deeply disturbing at first. I was like, this feels like someone is playing a trick on me now that I've gotten here.
And why, and Adam, why did it feel that way?
Well, I mean, it's just not a name that feels like it would roll off the tongue or be chosen for a convenience store. I'm sort of back on your like Shell or Conoco, right? Like I was like, okay, I'm prepared for those sorts of things. Also, I was a little disgruntled at first because I'd asked, where do you get a good cup of coffee? And someone sent me to Wawa, which is sort of true, but also not really what I was asking. You know, I was thinking like coffee shop that you might recommend to me, that I'm now in this new area and I was sent to Wawa. That did not like leave a good taste in my mouth, not literally in this case, but like figuratively. So like there are some pieces there, but I got over it. Eventually I came to appreciate Wawa and the many bagels it offered.
So you broke down your own barriers and your own initial reaction to form a trust of this place. It's not a coffee shop because you weren't specific. You just said, where do I get coffee? And so you broke down and you recognized the assumptions that you were making or that were made.
Series of assumptions about my neighbor at that point, but yes.
Which we don't need to go into.
Right.
But it got me thinking. Like I started off with a question about truck stops and a story about my favorite fake Mexican food as a child, because it's a low stakes endeavor. And even out here, the war between Wawa and Sheetz for many people doesn't seem like a low stakes endeavor. And if you're listening to this podcast and you live in the Northeast, you know what I mean. People lose friendships over which is better, Sheetz or Wawa. You know, if you're in Chicago, you know, the various deep dish pizza places, that which is the superior one, and you have your group and your tribe. And that's kind of low stakes stuff, and we can kind of joke about it. And it's funny to draw these imaginary lines between us. But I was at breakfast this morning with a colleague from church, and the diner that we normally go to has been playing Fox News on the TV behind the bar all the time. Ever since I've been here, I moved here 6 years ago, they have only ever had Fox News on 24 hours a day. So as of recording this podcast, a few days ago, President Trump went on Twitter and trashed Fox News and said that they no longer work for us. Presumably, I think he was talking about the American people, but it really sounded more like he was talking about himself and his people. And he said, it's time to find a new network. and has been encouraging people to ditch Fox News. So we went to breakfast this morning, and Fox News was not on the television anymore.
Wow.
Now it was the local news station. And then they were playing some daytime talk show that is inane and ridiculous. And it got me thinking.
Like, wow. Holy moly.
So we have competing levels of trust. These people at this restaurant, they trusted Fox News long before they trusted Trump. That was their main source of information and their identity. And Fox News embraced Trump wholeheartedly at the beginning. And then during the presidency and everything, and it was only really recently that they've been a bit more critical of him. And now that he has turned on them, they've shown that their trust in him is greater than their trust in the network that was kind of home base. And I thought how quickly we can just turn sides like that. And frankly, how scary that is.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious where you all sort of think that sort of trust comes from. Because I think this is a really interesting question about how we choose to trust particular sources but not others, and why we choose to do that. And I think this is because I deal a lot with college students who are often being browbeaten by professors about not using peer-reviewed sources and stuff like that. That for me, when I think about these questions about like, how do you choose a good, trustworthy source? How do you come to do that kind of trusting of other folks? Like, where does that come from for y'all? I ask that because I truly don't know, like for myself, like I would have to think about it a little bit to sort of really figure out like, well, this is why I trust this thing so much. And I'm wondering if we get like different sorts of trust that come from sort of looking at that.
I think from a broad stroke perspective, the trust comes from our village, right? Whoever is within our village. So if that includes your parents or some close family members, your circle of friends, whoever comprises your own personal village, that is inherently where the trust comes from. So I trust, I might not know anything about the difference between, say, Fox News and CNN. But if someone told me, if someone really close, if my best friend said, you should definitely watch CNN, then I'd say, okay, I trust that. Or if someone says, you know, I was reading the New York Times and it just is not fair to Israel. And as a Jew, I have a different colored lens looking at the New York Times and how it's not anti-Semitic. I would not go that far. I would, however, say it clearly colors the Jewish population and its coverage of Israel in a light that I would not see in other publications. And at this, so I recognize that, okay, so from that lens, right, from the Jewish Israel lens, the New York Times, I'm a little bit more wary of. And yet, and here's where I think our internal contradictions get to us. And yet I'll still read, without that dose of skepticism, other articles in the New York Times and ignore that skepticism. And I'll just read it saying, oh, well, they don't have a bias. And yet if it's about Israel, of course they have a bias. And I know that internally. So it's like, why? And I think we have our blinders on even when we are an expert, and I'm using that term very loosely in something, and we are confronted with whatever source we trust, if it goes against our own expertise, we tear it apart and we're like, no, it doesn't work. And look how wrong they are. And I just know that they're not correct. And then I turn the page or, you know, I watch a different show, whatever the source of media is. And it's like I've turned my own page of giving over my sense of expertise. So for me, going all the way back to your question, Adam, where does this sense of trust come from? It comes from the people that I know and who I know as people trust and their sources of trust, and we as a collective then trust.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking, that trust can be granted to another through means. I think of
proxy.
Yeah. Like there are some, there is a whole bunch of educational YouTube channels that I think are fantastic. You know, Smarter Every Day and Veritasium and SciShow, and these YouTube channels and their creators tend to cross-pollinate a bit. And when one of them is featured on another one's show, I find myself then in just intrinsically trusting them more, because they have now been given the stamp of approval from somebody that I have placed my trust in. Now, why did I place my trust in that first person to begin with? Maybe because somebody else I trusted put their stamp on that person. And then why did I do that person? And then at probably one or two steps back, I've forgotten why I trusted them in the first place. I just do, and it seems right, and there is only so much processing power in my brain that it just takes shortcuts. And that's just what it is. And I'm okay with that most of the time until I start examining it. And then I realize I'm less so. There was a study done at Yale, papers written by Jeffrey Cohen, and they asked a number of students from Yale about a social services program. Are you familiar with this study?
Yes, this is a great study.
I've heard of it.
Shows tribalism to the core.
So, for our listeners.
And who was the author?
Basically, Jeffrey Cohen.
Okay, that's right.
So basically what they did, their methodology, was that they had a group of Yale students, and they gave them a number of tests to determine where they were politically leaning, and then kept that aside. And they presented the group with a fictional welfare program that was extremely generous, more generous than anything that we have ever had in our country, and then asked them how favorably you rate that. And no surprise, the more liberal students rated it higher than the more conservative students. And then they did the same thing with a program that was more strict than anything we've ever done before. And what you'd expect happened, the more conservative ones said, well, yeah, lesser spending, that's wonderful. The liberal ones were like, oh, you heartless people, this is terrible. But then with another group, they gave them the really generous program, but they told them that a conservative group had proposed it. And the liberal people, the liberal people viewed it as being less favorable than before, against their own convictions, or at least what you would assume would be their convictions. And when asked afterwards about why they chose this, how important was party affiliation, they all rated party affiliation at the lowest. And, you know, this happened with the conservative group as well, that they were more likely to vote with the party that they affiliated with than with the actual policy itself. And they found something really interesting too, that if it was applied to a specific politician and it was extremely in the other direction, they were more likely to be on board with it the further it was from that person's normal position. So for example, if Bernie Sanders came out with a plan that slashed taxes for the upper class and that was supposedly going to save the world, there would be more people who are very liberal who would support that, because I suppose it's because it's so out of character that they trust that he has an idea, something that is beyond what he's done before, something radical, right? And so I found that study to be fascinating and terrifying, because my first reaction is to be like, oh, of course, you sheeple, you're voting with your party and not with your mind. But then, if I'm being honest,
that was 17-year-old Zach.
Oh yeah, the angsty one. Yeah, yeah.
Who we heard
Zanga
last week.
One.
Yep.
Oh man, I will not read you my 17-year-old's post about John Kerry. We will just not go there.
Right. So you heard that voice and you kept going because you have evolved since then.
Yes, but I, and partially because I've preserved my Zanga from those times, I can't be dismissive of other people. I just can't, because I know where I've been and I know how I've been affected by my own self. And so I look at it now and I think I'm being objective, and I think I'm trusting the proper sources, and I think I'm trusting them because they are academically rigorous and they've got studies and peer review and all the things that I cherish. And I think that's why. But if I'm being honest, if there was a scientist with a PhD after their name who showed up on Fox and Friends and was talking about some environmental issue, I would immediately not believe them. I would have no trust in that person whatsoever. And I don't like that about me, but I recognize that it's true. And if we're being honest, I think all of us do that as well.
Makes me think about the article that Jeff Middleman released recently. He wrote for Orbiter magazine about how the messenger, you know, is more important than the message itself. And I think that goes right into what you just said, Zach, about if a scientist was on Fox News, that you wouldn't trust the scientist right away. And yeah, if I'm honest, I feel the same way because of the original source, the platform that's being used to share what could be a very important message. I don't trust the platform. I don't trust the provider itself. But, and so because
but
of that.
But dare I say that, I'm sorry, I keep interrupting.
No it's okay. But because of that, I try to, like, that's my instinct. My instinct is to, I know that I have not trusted this news provider, Fox News, for a long time. So I'm not going to trust anyone using them to get their message out. That's the first thing that hits my mind. I always try my best to push that bias aside and say, if this is a, you know, what I think I try to do, if I notice like a description of somebody and where they provide information, where they write for, or where they've contributed, and I see a list of places, and one of them is Fox News, but then there are other sources that I tend to trust more, then I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and I'll give it a shot, but I will still verify information. Even if I get it from a source I automatically trust right away because of my tribe, I will sometimes, you know, verify information, but I won't necessarily do it as quickly.
I think there's actually a third piece that you're kind of dancing around. We have the message, the messenger, and the outlet.
Yeah.
So you're still talking, what you're really talking is messenger and outlet, not message and messenger. So for example, I can say I don't have a PhD, right? I don't have those letters behind my name. I know a little bit about chemistry, having gotten a degree in it and worked in the field for 10 years. So, but nobody knows who I am in that realm, and I'm totally okay with that. But if I were to, you know, if I were to have an opinion that was based in my understanding of what I did as a chemist, for example, I worked for a company that did biofuels. So I understand biofuel technology. I understand how it can be used and where it wants to go in our society. So I can say something about that. But because I have no clout as a messenger, my message might be completely not heard. And that would be regardless of what platform or outlet I was using to get across that message. Now, mm-hmm. if we bring in somebody else who actually has clout in the populace as a messenger, then their message will actually be heard. But then we have the additional piece of, well, what is your platform? So if we take a different example, right? If Ken Ham starts talking about the age of the Earth, I'm not going to believe him. I'm not going to believe his message because of who the messenger is. And then all the more so depending where his platform is, no matter what he's saying. But then if I do take somebody who I have that trust in, let's say Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I say, oh, he's now talking about the age of the earth, I'll probably listen because I trust the messenger. I'll probably trust his message more. And I will then give the benefit of the doubt to the platform that he's using. So whether that is Scientific American or Nature Magazine or Fox News or CNN, because I trust the messenger, the platform then gets even more of my respect. And I think that's a level that we need to be understanding of too.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that we trust implicitly, and in you almost have to lose that trust, and that we're more likely to trust some things over other things without thinking about it, because we have to formulate some kind of shortcut. We can't discern the trustworthiness of every single statement from every single person in every single place. We don't have the time or the processing power to do that. We kind of have to come up with baseline levels of trust for different institutions and different people so that we can function. Maybe once our brains get uploaded into cyborg machines and we have the aid of Google Assistant in our brains or whatever, we're able to do that. But for now, I, for better or for worse, have to trust certain institutions and certain people, which brings me to kind of the thing that started this in conversation in my mind, was that the trust in science, trust in scientific institutions, has steadily been in decline among only two groups of people: conservatives and people who regularly attend church. Among independents, among non-church-going people, among liberals, it's remained fairly constant, if not a little bit of an uptick in the past 40 years. But among regular churchgoers and conservatives, it has declined. Meanwhile...
And you say conservatives, you mean political or religious?
Political conservatives, yes. Not religious. Meanwhile, trust in religious institutions among the general populace has also declined. I'm looking at a graph right now from Gallup about Americans' rating of honesty and ethical standards of clergy, and it has just
taken a
nosedive. That we are
that
no
was a
longer
scary survey.
Yeah, we are in the bottom percentage of respected professions now, and people don't trust us. Just implicitly,
which one?
When I tell
those
people I'm a
Gallup?
Pastor, they stop talking. Yeah,
yeah. Just recent, last couple of months.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes. And so my hypothesis, which if you'll remember from episode 2, is an idea you can test. Thank you, buddy.
Yes.
Dinosaur train.
we should have a dinosaur train segment every week until Dr. Scott the paleontologist joins us.
I'm going to reach out to that guy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I love that guy. I mean, anyway, it's not like he would remember me, but I still want to reach out to him. Anyway, go ahead. Carry on.
So what you start to see is trust in science among conservative groups, politically speaking, starts to decline at about the time that regulatory scientific agencies and the government start to rise, the EPA and such. All of these scientific groups within the government, which are telling business that they can't do certain things, then they start to draw the ire of conservatives, and the scientific community gets conflated with regulatory agencies within the government. And then around that same time as well, you get the rise of the religious right, which so deeply embedded itself within evangelical Christianity and political conservatism that the two became just inextricably linked. And you start to see at this time as well, this rise in alternative science. I think Kendra talked about this a few weeks ago. that you had people like Ken Ham and others, which we keep mentioning as well. And, you know, if he wants to join us, that's fine too. But
we definitely invite him onto our show.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I learned a lot of my early science from Ken Ham growing up. And it was an attempt to reconcile scripture with some of the things we see in nature, putting the most of authority on scripture and not on what we see in nature. But that rise of this whole separate world where you had your own scientists, you had at Christian bookstores, there were signs and guides that would say, if you like listening to Blink-182, then you would like Reliant K. And all of these, if you like reading Stephen King, then you'll love reading Frank Peretti. There were just these one-for-one translations so that you did not have to engage in worldly things at all. You had your own education system, your own colleges and schools and music and publications and radio stations and books and everything. You did not have to touch the world, as it were. But we could be in the world, but not of the world. It's the phrase that we used all the time. And that leads to a certain distrust. And I think we saw in my Zanga post I read a few weeks ago that I saw all liberal institutions as godless and trying to take away my rights of religion. And I did not trust them in the least. They had no trust in my book because I put all my trust in my Christian institutions and they were diametrically opposed. So that's my hypothesis, and as well as a few other folks that I've read, that we can really draw this back to politics of the Conservative Party was the party at the time that was the party of big business. When regulatory science agencies started rising up, they made themselves enemies, they became enemies, and we all just believe that this is just the way it's always been.
I would add, though, beyond the confluence or convergence of politics and science in the 70s, give or take. And there are plenty of things to read where we can see the rise of the change of the conservative political movements as has changed and maps onto the conservative Christian side of things. I could say religion, but I'm not sure if that fits. I want to sound a little curmudgeonly and say it's all the internet's fault. because there is this idea of ignorance is bliss, and that if we move prior to the internet age, prior to the infotainment age of cable news, right? And I love that term, infotainment. How do you, it's entertainment because they're trying us to buy their product or to keep them in business. So, you know, you look at the commercials and you have to stay tuned. I mean, and this is so clear when you look at a weather forecaster, right? Especially at, you know, the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news and like, stay tuned. What's going to happen with our weather? I'm like, I'm going to bed. Like, it doesn't, yeah. I don't really need to stay tuned. Like, there's no excitement that I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, but they have to frame it in that way so that I do. So infotainment, information as entertainment. So with those things, and then the internet came along and gave us a democratization of information so that everyone has access to all information, whether or not they're an expert, they have an opinion, it doesn't really matter. And you couple that with everyone becomes an expert, then suddenly all we get are echo chambers. Soapbox over.
You know, I think, and I've been on a 18th century kick recently, which who doesn't have their 18th century period, right?
I'm much more about the 19th century.
Yeah, right. But yeah. I'm pretty sure I've not had an 18th century period.
Yeah.
So this is, I guess, technically 19th century, but the election election well, of 1800.
There's a big right distinction. On
the
cusp.
This is the best transition I think I have ever done. Yeah. But the election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson,
which was a
vicious election. In those days, politicians couldn't directly attack each other. They also didn't campaign. They said that it wasn't dignified for a politician to campaign. So they had their people go out and write articles in local newspapers and whatnot, because everything was a local newspaper. And their people, which were paid on the side, not officially a part of the campaign, would say all the terrible things they wish they could. And you should just look up some of these insults. They're wonderful. But my favorite one was that someone who was writing on behalf of John Adams started spreading the rumor that Thomas Jefferson was dead.
Oh,
so you can't vote for a dead guy. Right. So all the slanderous attacks back and forth about their character and their warmongering and how much they love France and how much they love England and they want to be king and blah, 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 blah. But man, he's dead. So word got out.
Argument
he was dead.
Over.
Right. And word could spread, and then it wouldn't spread as far or as fast as it does now.
Right.
But it would also take a lot longer for that rumor to be dispelled than it is now. And but we're
harder
in a place
to
now
verify
where, yeah, news travels a lot faster now. Misinformation travels a lot faster now.
Mm-hmm.
But correct information also travels really fast. And so it's easier to correct things. And the damage can still be done, greatly done.
Yeah.
Before, what do they say? A lie's been halfway around the world twice before the truth has put his pants on or something like that. That's not the saying, but it's similar to that.
But hold on. I want to stay with that saying for just a minute. A lie's been around the world twice before the truth puts its pants on is definitely going to be worked into pretty much all of the lectures that I need to give for like the next week.
Yeah. Can you record yourself doing those possible, and we can include them in the podcast?
Oh, man.
It's very challenging, though, to fight or to fight against lies and misinformation. I think that is something that with the fact that information is shared so freely now and false information just is flying all over the place, it's so hard. Like, so when you come back to politics and you see in debates, for example, right, in a debate between two candidates or however many candidates, that it's very hard to fact check them right then and there. And so they'll say anything a lot of times. Sometimes the stuff that they're saying, there's some truth to that. And then they'll kind of, elaborate some. And that's where the misinformation comes in and the lying comes in. That's the soundbite that's shared, right? Mm. The soundbite that then follows up later on by the fact checkers and by others saying, well, that's not accurate, never travels as far as the original soundbite. So whenever you see like a correction in a newspaper article, for example, the original statement that was false typically is what stays with people versus the one that is the corrected statement, because the corrected statement never reaches the same amount of people. It just doesn't.
Hmm.
So that's, and we know that from, when you're talking about, years of research when it comes to alternative conceptions and helping people and going through conceptual change within education, that it is very challenging to get rid of an alternative conception with accurate information. Hmm. I mean, that is really hard to do as a teacher. So that's why one of the things I emphasize in my science methods courses with students is that, and this comes into the play about being a teacher, and we're talking all about trust. And, teachers tend by their students, tend to have some level of trust, especially at the younger ages. But there's this perception out there that within teachers, we're supposed to know everything. And if we answer a question with, I don't know, or let me find out, that could potentially erode that trust. There's that fear there. I try to teach my students that it's so much better and a lot more powerful for them as teachers to say to a student, I don't know, than it is to make it up. because whatever it is they're going to make up is going to sound a lot more elaborate and interesting than potentially the truth. And that's what students will remember. And then they have to spend potentially weeks or longer to help students overcome that wrong information. So
I would add that it is.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know. And let's find out together.
Yep.
Or I don't know and I'll get back to you. Right. It's not just, I don't know. It's and. I think that's really important to say. It's okay that you don't know. If you want to exist and continue not knowing, that's where we might have a challenge.
Right.
And depending on the question and the abilities of the person asking the question, it can be, let me find out for you or let us find out together.
Mm. Right. So if any of my former students who are now teachers out there are listening, remember, it's okay to say, I don't know, and let's find out together, or I will find out for you, than it is to just make it up.
Okay. Yeah, and in that vein, going back to the quote that Zach just gave us, it is a real and fake quote at the same time. It's fantastic. So I looked it up for us. Colin Kaepernick said that statement of a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on, but he attributed it to Winston Churchill, which there's no way that Winston Churchill could have said that because he didn't wear pants.
Trousers.
He wore trousers or breeches, which is another possibility. And so then it goes all the way back to, well, maybe Mark Twain said it, but probably not. And then I'll spare y'all the full details. The furthest back that we see is Jonathan Swift writing in The Examiner in 1710. Falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after it.
Go back to the 18th
and
century.
And he probably didn't.
Right? We're having our 18th century phase.
Back to the 18th century moments.
It's inherently untrustworthy.
Bringing it back. And he probably didn't create it. This is how it goes. But I really want to add to that piece, though, that a lie. And I really. Let me take us down a wormhole real fast. I think our language, which is stunted enough, we have so many more ideas than we're able to express with the limited ability with our language, even if we have fantastic vocabulary. Our language still has to maintain a sense of unbiased to it as much as we can. Is there any reason to say alternative something or other? Why can't we just call it a lie? Alternative facts are not facts, they're lies, right? One of the, not to get personal or over emotional, one of them is non-consensual sex. That doesn't right. exist. It's called rape.
Right.
So why would we call that underage women? There is no such thing as underage women. They're girls, right? But if we use those terms in a different way, if we use our language to get across a softening of, then I think we're really doing ourselves a disservice when we're looking at this understanding of who do I trust and how do I do that? And it's not just for those pieces. We even say it to each other. Oh, you know, so-and-so passed away. No, he didn't. He died. Right? We can handle the truth, right? We also have to make sure that our language is giving us the trust that we're trying to seek. So I currently say to my five-year-olds, my cell phone needs to be charged. Its battery ran out. My cell phone didn't die because right. I then plug it in and it comes back to life. That's not how death works. Our dog died. He's not coming back. Right. And my son is not listening to the podcast. So it's okay that I say it like that.
Right.
We have to use our language in a way that gives us the trust of people who talk to us. And so when we're saying that a lie travels further and faster, I think it also muddies, and we have to make sure that we're actually calling it a lie. We know what a lie is. We don't know what an alternative fact is.
But I think you also get into a conversation about intent, right? And so part of this is you know, when we look at it like journalistically, right? A lot of the research that I've been doing right now is on like alternative facts, right? And what's the sort of like relationship that alternative facts have in different religious and in religious communities, and how those then affect the way that they hear scientific stories,
right?
And so there's this journalistic intent to say, well, we don't use the word lie to describe an alternative fact because I can't verify the intent of the person who's put it forward, right? So to call it a lie is to put intent upon that person. And it's this sort of interesting thing.
But as does calling it a fact as an alternative fact, though. Right, that puts an intent on what you're saying, right? So I agree. Labeling it as a lie does color a particular way, but saying it's an alternative fact colors what you're talking about too, as that it is factual and therefore could be proven. And
sure,
I think that's equally misleading.
Well, but it's not coloring the person who said it; it's coloring the information.
But I feel like there is a difference, though, between
satisfying as an answer, but I think that's what's going on.
But there's a difference between the word lie and liar.
Agreed.
There is a difference. There's a distinction there. Lie is coloring the information. Liar is coloring the person, right? And so I do remember a conversation I had years ago with someone, and they accused me of something, and I said, well, no, that's a lie. The response to that from this individual was, don't call me a liar. And I do remember specifically saying, I'm not calling you a liar. I just said what you told me was a lie. There is a difference. We just make there you can argue there's a connection, but they are two different things.
Well, it's the difference between paying with counterfeit money and making counterfeit money.
Well, it's also putting an action to a personality in another way of putting this, putting a disease as a personality, right? There's a difference in saying the diabetic told me, or a person with diabetes, right? I'm putting the person first. It's not, this is a person who has schizophrenia, a schizophrenic, right? Which am I valuing more, right? When my child acts out, he's not a bad person. His behavior is undesirable,
right?
So we're recognizing that the personhood comes first, but the words and actions add to what they are. And I think that goes back to the piece of trust, right? That how do we know if a person is trusting or deserves of our trust, a person or organization or, you know, whatever.
So that's an amazing segue, because that was my final question before we head out. I have to go get my son. Is why should people trust us?
Us who?
Us on this podcast.
Okay.
Presumably, you're listening. You're trying to figure out if you're going to trust us and keep listening. If you're going to take what we say at face value, or if you're going to doubt everything we say, or if you're going to hate us and write bad reviews on iTunes, you know, why should people trust us?
I think it's because of the fact that I'm hopeful people will realize that we are doing our best to be authentic. That we're not trying to do lip service to topics, that we're actually authentically exploring these topics ourselves and being raw with our feelings on these topics and willingly displaying vulnerability. I think that goes a long way with people when they recognize that, oh, so I don't know these people, but this this guy, Ian, talks about how he really struggles when he reads the Bible. I struggle too with it. I'm curious what else, what does he have to say? I'm not the only one. So I think it's, I think that has a lot to do with it, is for the fact that we do display our vulnerability for others. What do you think, somebody else?
Ian? I certainly think it has nothing at all to do with the honorifics before all of our names.
Nope.
You doctors and
agreed.
Us rabbi and reverend.
I think initially it's by word of mouth. It's obviously our friends, our families, our people who know us are going to listen in. And then they will spread. Just like we talked about at the very beginning about trust is based a lot on community. Right? But I think it will expand beyond that to others of hearing our message. But Rachel is shaking her head, so honest, I'd love to know why you're shaking your head.
Disagree, Rachel.
I do disagree. Not because I disagree with what you're saying or that that's how we're portraying ourselves. I disagree because I actually disagree with a question.
Yeah, Zach. We don't agree with your question.
What was that?
I said, we don't agree with your question, Zach.
I don't agree with a question.
All right, hit me with your philosophical non-answer. Go ahead. Let's move
Gauntlet
the goalposts.
Throne. Okay. When you're trusting, there is a purpose to trusting, right? Why should I trust my bookshelf? Well, I should trust my bookshelf that it's not going to collapse when I put my books on it, right? There's a trust inherent in there. Why should my congregation trust me? Because they know I'm going to be here when they need me. But for anyone listening to this podcast, what are we preventing from happening? What are we saying that could increase or what is the trust that we're seeking? What authority? Because trust then also goes to authority, right? Trust goes into a concept of valuation. And for me, our value here is of conversation. Our value is dialogue, discussion, philosophical debates, more questions than there are possibilities of answers. And the trust is just that, you know, we won't bore people. I think that, and so for me, I don't know, it's a low stakes. It's a non-question.
I think you will find that some of the things that are said in this podcast will challenge people at their
Agreed.
Core, will challenge a lot of assumptions. And for those going through transitional periods of their identity, their faith, intellectual identities, that having something stable to hold on to, having a name, a figure, an author, a person, a podcast, a show, something that they can claim when they're tribeless can be really helpful. I know for me, I can name a couple of authors that were that for me. And so I think that it is a valid question. And I think that people shouldn't trust us, at least not on episode one. You should keep listening and you should let us earn that trust. Let us convince you over time that this is not a dangerous place and that this is a place where you can maybe find a tribe, maybe find a community, maybe find where you're going next with your faith, with yourself. And that is best done in community, not just through listening to a bunch of people talk for an hour on your car speakers, but done by interacting, by asking questions, by emailing us questions or writing on the Facebook page or whatever it may be, of going back and forth, of disagreeing with us. I would love it if people would disagree with me.
Yeah.
I mean, y'all have no problem disagreeing with me.
None.
I'm good.
And I hope that others do as well, as I hope that we can earn trust, because I know that as a clergy person, that's my whole life, is I now have to earn everyone's trust. I am not trusted, and my institution is not trusted, so I have to earn it personally, and I think that is a good way to navigate these waters when we're really talking about such high-stakes things as chichis and Wawa.
The Wawa conversation was very important, though.
So what do you think, Adam?
I don't know. Which makes me feel like I should stay silent and say, well, we'll figure that out together later.
There you go. Instead of making up your answer.
Instead of making up my answer.
So
right?
You listened to me. That former student, did you hear that?
Right? Yeah. Those who can't see the huffing and puffing that I'm doing, please know that I find this question very irritating.
How did that person describe you? That they can
hear my sigh coming
depth
down
of
the hallway.
A sigh.
Yeah,
by the depth of the sigh coming down the hallway.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so that sounds not maybe right on the radio sort of stuff. Anyway, so
all right, take us home, Dr. Pryor.
Yeah, I'm gonna bring it back. I think there are two things that come up for me. So one is that I do think we should be trusted because of the letters after our name. And that's in part because I have a sort of intellectualist bent to say, like, there's something conferred by the authority of that that's important to say, like, other people have vested in us to say that we're trustworthy. And that's an institution that needs to be trusted, those letters after people's names. So, but I don't think that's enough, and I get that. So for me, the other reason to trust us is that willingness to say, I don't know. That to me is almost sacred in terms of the vulnerability that it requires to be with other people and say that. And so I think part of what, in my mind, makes this a trustworthy endeavor is that everybody who shows up, to me, it's sort of a rule. If you're going to show up, you have to at least be willing to say, I don't know. I did bring it home after sighing strangely into the microphone. I'm just saying, it was good.
This has been episode 7 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to go on this journey with us. I know there are a thousand other things that you could and maybe should be doing, but you're here with us instead, and that is such an honor. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes and links to all our social media accounts. Join us next week as we continue our conversation on trust, dystopian hellscapes, and fun fake facts about Taco Bell. It is a really fun episode.
And to any people out there who really love Taco Bell, I'm sorry, but...